As I Saw Him, No. 2 by S.S. Cohen. The 3rd of February 1936, early morning, saw my horse cart rolling on the uneven 2.5-mile road from Tiruvannamalai railway station to Ramanashramam. Two sleepless nights in the train from Bombay found me tired in body and mind. My head was swimming and my senses confused. I had hoped for some rest at the ashrama, but when I arrived there at last, there was not a soul to be seen anywhere. Presently, a corpulent man with a giant, rugged head and scarlet red lips from perpetual chewing of betel nuts appeared. "Is that Mr. Cohen? Follow me quickly before the Maharishi goes out for his walk," he called out. I obeyed, extremely eager to see the great sage who had haunted me night and day for 3 long months. I was led to a small dining room, at the door of which I was asked to remove my shoes. As I was trying to unlace them, my eyes fell on a pleasant-looking middle-aged man inside the room, wearing nothing but a cowpeen, with eyes as cool as moonbeams, sitting on the floor before a leaf plate nearly emptied and beckoning me with the gentlest of nods and the sweetest smile imaginable. It was then the ashrama's custom to honor the newcomer by giving him his first meal in a line directly opposite the Maharishi's seat and at hardly 4 feet distance from it. I took no notice of the cakes, although my hand fingered them, but directed my whole look at the peaceful countenance of Shri Bhagavan. He had by then finished eating and was slowly rolling a betel leaf for a chew, as if deliberately to give me a little more of his company, when a man entered from the back door, which was the passage to the small kitchen, and in a low voice said something in Tamil to him. Then Maharishi rose, looked at me by way of farewell, and left the room. I hastily swallowed half a cake, gulped the cup of tea, and went out in search of my room, to which my luggage had been taken, when someone announced that Sri Maharishi was coming to the Darshan Hall. I rushed straight to the hall with my hat and full suit on. Behind me, calmly walked in the tall, impressive figure of the Maharishi with leisurely, though firm steps. I was alone in the hall with him. Joy and peace suffused my being. Such a delightful feeling of purity and well-being at the mere proximity of a man I never had before. My mind was already in deep contemplation of him. Him not as flesh, although that was exquisitely formed and featured, but as an unsubstantial principle which could make itself so profoundly felt despite the handicap of a heavy material vehicle. When, after a while, I became aware of my environment, I saw him looking at me with large, penetrating eyes wreathed in smiles rendered divinely soothing by their childlike innocence. Bhagavan was then enjoying the sound, robust health of middle age and could very well afford to be available at almost all hours of the day to devotees. The years 1936-1938 were very blissful indeed to us when we could gather round his couch and speak to him as intimately as to a beloved father, tell him all our troubles and show him our letters without let or hindrance. After 8 p.m., when the hall contained only the local residents, we sat round him for a family chat till about 10 o'clock. Then he related to us stories from the Puranas or the lives of saints, yielding to transports of emotion when he depicted scenes of great bhakti or great human tragedies to which he was sensitive to the extreme. Then he shed tears, which he vainly attempted to conceal. On one occasion, Bhagavan recited from memory a poem of a Vaishnava saint in which occurred the words, "Fold me in thy embrace, O Lord." When the arms of Bhagavan joined in a circle around the vacant air before him and his eyes shone with the devotional ardour, while his voice shook with stifled sobs which did not escape our notice, it was fascinating to see him acting the parts he related and be in such exhilarated moods as these. Some disciples and his attendants used to sleep on the floor of the hall at night. Bhagavan's sleep was very light. He woke every now and then, and almost always he found an attendant nearby fully awake to say a few words too, and then sleep again. Once or twice he would go out for a few minutes, and by 5 a.m. when the Veda chanters came from the township, they found him fully awake and chatting in a soft, subdued voice. Now the Parayanam would get started and go on for little less than an hour, during which everybody abstained from talking, and Bhagavan often sat cross-legged and completely indrawn. Then he went out on the hill and returned at about 7:30, when visitors and devotees began trickling in, men, women and children, till they filled the hall by about 9 a.m. This morning hour of the Parayanam was the best time of the day for meditation. The congregation was small, women and children absent, the weather cool, and the mind had not yet completely emerged to run its usual ride. Over and above this, Bhagavan then shone in the stillness of his samadhi, which permeated the hall and the meditation of his disciples. Bhagavan went out at his usual hours. These were 9:45 for a few minutes, 11 o'clock for luncheon, followed by the midday stroll in Parakuttu, evening 4:45 on the hill preceding the evening Veda Parayanam, and 7 o'clock for dinner. The constant influx of visitors was of some help in that it afforded the much needed relaxation to an otherwise tense life. Secondly, the peculiar problems which visitors brought with them were a useful study. Watching the masterly ways Bhagavan tackled these problems was a sadhana in itself. Rationality was the very essence of his arguments, while the ultimate answer to all the questions was always the same, namely, find out who you are. He first met every questioner on his own ground and then slowly steered him round to the source of all problems, the self, the realization of which he held to be the universal panacea. When the audience shrank, he at times became humorously autobiographical about his early school and home life, or about his many experiences on the hill with sadhus, devotees, etc. As time passed and the master's state of mind and ideas took firm root in me, I ceased to ask questions or to intercept him in his walks outside the ashrama grounds, as I used to do in the first 6 months. The final conclusion to which I came in the end of all these 6 months, I reported one day to Bhagavan. He showed his gracious approval by a gesture of finality, with his hand and said, "So much lies in your power. The rest must be left entirely to the Guru, who is the ocean of grace and mercy, seated in the heart as the seeker's own self." The builders had put the finishing touches to my small mud hut in Parakuttu Garden on 4th of April 1936. I completed my arrangements for the warming ceremony, known here as Griha Praveshan, to take place the next day. The invited devotees gathered in my hut, and about noon, the master himself strolled in on his way back from his usual walk, and refusing the special chair I had ready for him, he squatted like the others on the mat-covered floor. After the ceremony, Bhagavan left. I followed him from a distance, waited till the devotees cleared away, and approached him. "Bhagavan," I started, "you have given me a home for my body. I now need your grace to grant the eternal home for my soul, for which I broke all my human ties and came." He stopped in the shade of a tree, gazed silently on the calm water of the tank for a few seconds, and replied, "Your firm conviction brought you here. Where is there room for doubt? Where is there room for doubt indeed?" I reflected. 3 years had passed since that Griha Praveshan day. "Bhagavan," I said on a day then near my hut, "I feel a strong urge to go on yatra, pilgrimage. I feel that I need a change for some months, which I intend spending in holy places." He smiled approval and inquired about the date and time of my starting, and whether I had made arrangements for my stay in the various places I was to visit. Extremely touched by his solicitude, I answered that I was going as a sadhu, trusting to chance for accommodation. For 3 months thereafter, I lay on a mat in Cape Comorin, immensely relieved of the mental tension which the master's physical form had cast me. In solitude, I plunged into reflections on his blissful silence and calm repose. The stillness of his mind haunted me everywhere I went. In the beautiful gem-like temple of the youthful virgin goddess, on the shores of the vast blue ocean around me, and the sand dunes, in the fishing villages and endless stretches of coconut groves which ran along the seashore and the interior of the cape. I felt his influence in the depth of my soul and cried, "Oh Bhagavan, how mighty you are, and how sublime and all-pervasive is the immaculate purity of your mind. With what tender emotion do we, your disciples, think of your incomparable qualities, your gentleness, your serene, adorable countenance, your cool, refreshing smiles, the sweetness of the words that come out of your mouth, the radiance of your all-embracing love, your equal vision towards one and all, even towards diseased stray animals." Evening shadows. The years 1948-50 saw the evening shadows gathering and closing on the mortal coil of the master. Advancing age brought a series of mishaps to it. A fall, a nervous hiccup lasting many days, a clinging rheumatism, and lastly, a malignant tumor which inch by inch ate the flesh of his left arm, poisoned his blood, and finally rang down the curtain on an immaculate life. 22nd of February 1949. About a fortnight ago, the ashrama doctor, Dr. Shankar Rao, assisted by Dr. Srinivasa Rao, removed a very small growth from the left elbow of the Maharishi, since when it has remained bandaged. But today, the bandage has been removed and it is left exposed. It is presumed to have healed. 27th March 1949, the lump which was removed from Maharishi's left elbow last month and which was thought to be healing satisfactorily subsequently started to grow again, so that the eminent surgeon Dr. Raghuachari came today from Madras with surgical instruments to remove it. The surgeon, we are told, performed the operation skillfully by cutting deep and removing the last cell of growth. He does not expect a recurrence of the growth. 4th December 1949. This is Deepam Day, most holy to Hindus in the south. The holy beacon will be lighted tonight on top of Arunachala. Tonight, Sri Maharishi sat in the north veranda of the Darshan Hall. All around him, hundreds of devotees squatted. This jubilation is not without a sting. Will the health of Sri Maharishi favor us with another Deepam Day and he be with us in the flesh, or is this to be the last? As we see him seated fresh and bright as ever, gazing expectantly at the top of his beloved Arunachala, we cannot help being optimistic of his recovery. The body, which is stricken by a most malignant disease, hacked on many occasions by the surgeon's knife, burnt by radium, and drugged by all sorts of powerful drugs, bears no trace of the agonizing ordeal in the brilliance of its eyes or in the joyful expressions of its face. What miracles are being performed in it? What are its mysteries? The proceeding was gathered from the pages of S.S. Cohen's book, Guru Ramana.